This is UN and Africa from the United Nations in New York. I'm Matt Wells. In this programme, Somalia's security rests on reaching political agreement and restructuring the whole of society, the UN top representative there tells us. But there's real hope for the future. And what life lessons does volunteering for the UN teach you? We'll find out from one Kenyan woman lawyer. But first, more than two-thirds of UN emergency response funding still likely to go to alleviate humanitarian crises in Africa. That's according to the chief of the Central Emergency Response Fund, or CERF, Lisa Doughton, who said after the recent annual pledging conference for 2018 at UN headquarters that a total of $383 million had been registered for next year. With funding this year likely to be the highest since CERF's inception in 2006, she said next year's total was especially important since global needs have skyrocketed. $22.5 billion is required overall to support 92 million people in need across the world. Ms. Doughton told Mao Shi Li that donors across the world deserved a big thank you for their strong support.
Aside from the amount pledged to CERF, I'm really proud of the diversity that CERF's donors represent. They really embody the spirit of CERF as a fund for all, by all. A total of 47 member states that have received funding from CERF have also contributed to the fund. This is a strong show of broad support for the fund and a good indication of its importance. And I'm especially happy to welcome Al Jisr Foundation as a new donor, which is an Oman-based family foundation that derives its funds from the generous practice of zakat, charitable giving. This multi-year contribution represents a significant diversification of the donor base. And lastly, I was excited that today the Secretary General announced an allocation of $100 million from CERF to 9 underfunded emergencies, which are the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, Tanzania, Cameroon, Mali, Philippines, Eritrea, Haiti, and Pakistan.
The Emergency Relief Coordinator has just launched the 2018 Global Humanitarian Needs Overview, but the needs have again increased. So how is CERF handling such great demands?
In 2018, the global humanitarian needs are projected to be at record levels again, even higher than the ones we faced in 2017. And indeed, this puts pressure on CERF. For example, in early 2017, CERF was one of the first responders to the warning signs in Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen, where more than 20 million people were near famine. By the end of August, CERF had released nearly $128 million in grants and loans to support the most critical early action life-saving activities prioritized by the humanitarian team in each country, making it one of the largest funding sources in early stages of the response in 2017. Other very well-known humanitarian crises that benefited people affected by the hurricanes Irma and Maria in the Caribbean in September and the Rohingya refugees who are fleeing to Bangladesh. A large portion of the funds usually go to crises in Africa, and in 2015 and 2016, CERF allocated more than two-thirds of its annual funding to emergencies on the continent. And due to the overwhelming number of requests and the limited amount of funding available, we were forced to reduce the amount of money we would have normally given to several crises based on need. For example, in Sudan, we received a funding request of $9 million to assist conflict-affected people. And due to the lack of sufficient funds, we lowered the disbursement amount to $5 million.
Chief of CERF, Lisa Doughton there. Somalia's leaders are committed to ensuring a safe and sustainable future for the country's people, but no one should be under any illusion that this might take a long time. That's according to Michael Keating, who's head of the UN mission UNSOM. He was speaking from the capital Mogadishu during a major security and humanitarian conference earlier this month. Amid plans to draw down troops from the African Union mission AMISOM, stationed in Somalia, and boost Somali forces, Mr. Keating told Daniel Johnson how political leaders have shown their willingness to continue military reform.
The security conference was centered on the imperative of having two things in place as soon as possible. One is a plan for the transition of lead security responsibility from the African Union to the Somalis. At the moment, there are 22,000 AMISOM troops.
And is there sufficient capacity there to relieve that load?
Not at the moment, no. So that's the whole point of the gradual transition plan. I was going to say the second part of it is the need to strengthen the Somali security forces. And the key point that was made is that this is as much a political as a technical endeavor, because until the Somalis can reach a very strong political agreement, given 30 years of conflict, the absence of institutions and levels of distrust, They have to reach clear political understandings as to the basis upon which they're going to rebuild their army and their police force, their intelligence services and their maritime, plus recognize that security is not just about military activities. It's about community policing. It's about local governance. It's about rule of law. It's about addressing violent extremism. So it's quite an ambitious conference. And as I say, the central concept is that over the coming years, there should be a conditions-based transition from AMISOM to the Somalis, bearing in mind that AMISOM cannot stay forever. They've been here 10 years already. That the funding for AMISOM, whether it's through the UN or to voluntary contributions, mostly coming from the EU, that cannot go on forever. So there's got to be a horizon.
Maybe you could give me a key security and development project that might be extended to the rest of the country or parts of the country so that we can get a grasp of really what needs to be done.
There are certain locations in the country, not many so far, where AMISOM has actually drawn down and responsibility for security has then been assumed by local actors. And in order for them to step into that space created by the departure of AMISOM, they have to reach a clear understanding on roles and responsibilities. Now, this has been done on a small scale. It needs to be taken to a large scale. But no one is under any illusions as to how long this is going to take.
I guess the next question is the money. Funding is being drawn down. AMISOM want to leave. There's a lack of money and investment for this crucial plan.
I mean, at the moment, something like $1.2 billion is being spent on the formal security sector in Somalia. About $1 billion of that goes to AMISOM. And so the challenge there for Somalia is how does it start raising the revenues to pay its own way?
Michael Keating there, the head of the UN mission in Somalia, AMISOM. Volunteering with the UN has taught one Kenyan lawyer the value of interacting with people from around the world, something she says opens your mind and allows you to grow personally and professionally. Anne Kamunya is currently serving with the UN Refugee Agency in Turkey, where she interviews asylum seekers. Anne trained as a lawyer and is an advocate on Kenya's High Court, but she has had a passion for volunteering since her university days. Maoshi Lee spoke with the UN volunteer at a recent forum in Antalya, looking at how countries in the Southern Hemisphere can support each other.
United Nations volunteers are working with many other UN agencies and different government sectors to try and promote peace and development in these agencies. So they are doing different things, like I'm interviewing asylum seekers. And what UNV is doing is promoting volunteerism, helping young people by connecting young people just from school and those who have graduated and even people who have built their career, they have work experience to take their expertise to these agencies and build these agencies' capacity and helping them achieve their own goals and plans.
Working for the UN might have brought some kind of change on the part of yourself and in terms of the perspectives on the issues?
It has brought positive and maybe not so positive changes. First, the positive is that I've been able to meet different people from different countries and appreciate different cultures. So you have a bigger understanding of the world. I've also had the chance to meet people, my colleagues, who have more experience and who have worked in many different places and learning what they do and their work has changed me or has made me grow as a person. I came to learn working with UN does not necessarily mean you're going to change the world. UN is a big agency, but they work only under the if the host country where they are working allows them to do their job. So if the host country decides UN is not going to work in Kenya, for example, UN does not necessarily have the teeth or the power to force the government to let them do their job.
Do you encourage others to work for the UN?
Definitely I would, because you're working as part of this big international organization to create a difference in the world, especially in volunteerism. You don't necessarily get paid. You get some assistance on some money that will help you to live and survive, because at the end of the day, you still need to, you have your own personal needs.
Anne Kamunya there talking to Maoshi Lee. You've been listening to UN and Africa. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Matt Wells.